Okay, let's get going. Welcome everybody to the last lecture in the class. The quarter has gone very fast and we're down to the last lecture, but it's going to be a good one. So how many people went to the VA on Tuesday? Anybody care to relate their something surprising that they saw, something that impressed them? Ernestine? Well, I'm glad you didn't drive through any buildings. If you ever find yourself in a simulated car and you really want a thrill, Ernestine should be your driver. It was awesome. Anybody else have any comments or reflections? So, the VA, the two things that we saw were the clinic area where they do physical therapy and stuff, and there's lots of machines there. On the first day, I showed you a picture of Locomat, which is a robotic walker that you strap on, and so they have one at the VA there, and so they work very closely with a lot of paraplegics and quadriplegics there. So I'm glad everybody had a good experience there. Okay. A couple of administrative items. It's at the end of the quarter, and you know what the course requirements are as far as lectures that you need to attend and stuff. And I get worried about things. So one of the things I'm worried about are people that owe me lecture summaries and stuff. And if there's any chance at all that you won't make the deadline for turning in good summaries, you have to request an incomplete. And this isn't really too risky because once you complete your summaries, and that I get to change the incomplete to a real grade. But if you don't request an incomplete and you don't complete the required course elements, I can't give you a passing grade. So please keep that in mind. And if anybody's unsure of their situation, please email me, and I'll look at my sign-up list and see if there's anything that you owe me. This is sort of important. The three people that are doing individual presentations, please get in touch with me to schedule a presentation. The last item is that reports and individual reflections are due a week from tomorrow, but I understand that a lot of people have other projects due and finals and things like that. So if you need more time to do a good job, you know, please request, and I'll see what I can do. Any questions about this? If you have any questions at all, I'll probably be sending out an email about, you know, what to expect in the report. But I want to talk about individual reflection because maybe this is something that you don't know about. An individual reflection is basically a summary of your personal experiences working on a team or individual project. So these are, you know, just for people working on projects. And basically, you know, you tell, it's all non-technical stuff. You tell about, you know, what you expected from the course, why you took the course, things like team dynamics, any incidents you'd like to relate, any situations you want to describe, anything that surprised you, challenges, any ethical issues that you encountered, and how it relates to your academic and career plans, a new perspective you learned, and any description of your interaction with users or other people outside your team, and the value of the design process you used. And you can also add in things like comment on what would you do differently if you had to do it over again, what course content was helpful, the lectures and things like that, and what advice do you have for others. Okay. And this is individual reflections are done not by team but by individuals, and that can be just stapled together and submitted separately from your project report. Now for everybody working on projects, I have project folders, and I decided not to get the Spider-Man or Hannah Montana folders, so I got real folders this year. So please, if you're working on a project, please pick one of these up. Next Thursday, a week from today, is your reward. We're going to have a little celebration just down the hall here. And so we have a sign-up sheet for pizzas or burritos and a drink. So if you haven't already signed up, please, check one. If you have any special dietary requirements, there's a place on the bottom to sign up. Anybody who has attended at least one lecture is eligible to attend, so that means everybody in the class. Before that, we'll be doing a course evaluation. This will be your chance to rate the various lecturers. It's very important to know who did a good job, and I'll report back to the speakers about that. You also tell about evaluate the course and things like that. So it's actually a very important document for me because I look at that very carefully and decide how to change things for next year. So anything that you thought went particularly well, please put that down there so I know. And if there's things that you think you need more of or needs to be improved, put that down as well, and I'll do my best to make it an even better experience for students next year. Any questions? Oh, I wanted to do this short video on ableism. Now, this is sort of a term I hadn't heard about, and I'm not sure it's really in the mainstream yet, but I thought I'd present it for, because I thought it was sort of interesting. So let me get out of that into this. Oh, where? Oh, no. Where did I mute it? Oh, I see what I did. Let's start over. Unmute. That's a high school student. It's not a Stanford student, so.
Are you sure?
No, I haven't heard that one before.
I don't know if that's a
So this was a little video done by high school students.
Disabled people are They want people who can capably do the job. People with disabilities like Down syndrome and cognitive disabilities are rarely seen in that environment.
What would work for adults with developmental disabilities to be able to navigate through the process of finding jobs, improving job skills, and ultimately job placement? So they have all these things set up to help people who don't have jobs, but it's not really tailored or in any way for people who have disabilities. So they're trying to look at how some is not working, and we're glad to be a part of trying to figure out that process so that it can work.
Yeah, that's the way the video is. It's.
Oh, I get it.
No, I would hope it's a mistake.
It's a good effect.
Yeah. Half of it is moving and half of it isn't.
The biggest problem with fighting ableism is people don't believe it exists.
Okay. Not sure how much I agree with all that stuff, but it's an interesting commentary. Anybody have any thoughts about what you saw? John?
What, just out of curiosity, what components would you not agree with? Just totally.
I'm not sure what everybody thinks about people with disabilities. So to say that, you know, it's prevalent or not, I don't know. Okay.
I also
simplistic, yeah. Okay. John?
I noticed it was not simple for blind people to watch it.
Right. So, right. So it is visually oriented, and there really wasn't a way for Roger to view it. So it in itself was prejudiced against blind viewers. Okay. Anything else? Roger?
A couple things. One is that I keep hearing about fear and lack and ignorance and so forth, and I've been in this business doing this stuff for almost 50 years now, and I don't see the data. I don't see that we have the right answers. I don't believe that it's lack of education. And I'm not sure if it's fear, why is there racism, you know? And I just, my current irritation is people first language. I'm not sure, I want to see data that makes any difference, to say people who are blind rather than blind people.
Right.
Other than making the sentence more awkward.
Right. Well, I I think it reflects on how we think about others when we say, when we segregate people of differing abilities by saying blind people and the disabled and
so
the deaf and so on.
Are you a person with maleness?
Yeah, it does get awkward, and I agree with you on that. And but so there isn't really a good solution. But I do think there's a lot of people who just don't know how to treat people with disabilities, and I think there's a lot of that going around. So the first reaction that you might have is to, you know, stay away from them because you don't know what's appropriate or correct thing to do. So that's that. Okay. One more little thing. If anybody attended the VA tour and didn't sign up on the list and hasn't told me, please let me know so I can credit you with being there. So Tuesday will be the student project presentations. So that ought to be a good climax to the quarter. And everybody who's attending will be a judge. You get to fill out a form. As we did in the midterm, so be sure you attend that. And again, anybody is welcome, and if you're welcome to invite other people to attend, anybody that you happen to work with on your project or other friends or whatever, they're all welcome. So, but today we have the pleasure of having Ralph Hotchkiss again. Ralph has been an old friend of mine. We're both old.
Speak for yourself.
Ralph identifies himself as an inventor and Whirlwind wheelchair designer, whose company, Whirlwind Wheelchair International, designs wheelchairs for use and manufacture in developing countries, involving wheelchair riders in all its projects and activities. The organization's mission is to make it possible for every person in the developing world who needs a wheelchair to obtain one that will lead to their maximum personal independence and integration into society. Ralph is a graduate of Oberlin College, and he's a 1989 MacArthur Genius Foundation Fellow. So let's give Ralph a warm Stanford welcome. Let me give you this mic.
Work?
No,
does
that,
this?
That's just for recording.
Oh, okay.
And this mic is for
application. Okay, give that a test.
Test.
That sounds
workable.
Okay, let's switch over your computer.
The only downside is I'm now wired, and I'll have to drop this connection when I go up the stairs. So that last YouTube was thought-provoking, to say the least. It's nice to see those issues out and about being talked about. Brings back lots of memories when they say, whoever it was who was speaking at the time said that a lot of white people self-generate these fears of or prejudices against disability. It's because they, what did they say? They were afraid of. They had met only a few people with disabilities, but had kept their distance because they were afraid of. What did they say? Did anybody understand exactly why well, that's another aspect of it, yeah. But why were people personally afraid of being disabled themselves?
Because it could happen to you.
Yeah, I don't know. I was lucky enough, perhaps, to be the flip side of that. When I was preschooler, my grandpa had a friend who rode a wheelchair, and boy, was it fun to ride down a hill in his lap, fast. It was just a thrill. And it was, of course, a very old-fashioned wheelchair. I remember sitting in his lap and seeing these pipes around me as they were just about at my eye level, I guess. His chair was one of the designs from the 1930s and 40s that had these big square armrests that were an integral part of the folding frame. They couldn't get rid of them. And so basically you were rattling around in this little cage. Made it safe to carry three-year-olds at least. And I had another friend who was a blind guy who taught me a lot of his tricks. And sometimes I would feel sorry for his dog because when my friend was, for example, bump his head on a louvered window that was sticking out into a room, say, 5 feet high, the dog would walk him right under it, and my friend would hit his head on the open shutters, and then cuss out at his dog. Well, his dog was way down there. How could his dog see that? But we had a lot of fun, and he was very technical, and I was very interested in anything technical, and so he would teach me tricks as to how to do, for example, repairs on stuff that I couldn't quite reach and couldn't quite see, stuff that was around the corner, for example, automotive repairs. It was great, very interesting. He had the perspective that I needed in order to kind of go beyond my own limitations as a not yet disabled kid. But the real clincher was in college, freshman year. I was at Oberlin, which was a fairly open to disabilities college at the time. Was the first male female integrated college in the U.S. way back in the 1840s or so, and had gone on to work in particular with blind people and people with polio, other disabilities. And there were two women in my class, one blind woman, one woman with who had polio and rode a tricycle around campus at high speed. And I really liked both of them. And that made it all the more interesting. So when I had the opportunity to have my own disability later that year, freshman year, it was a challenge. It was very, very interesting. It wasn't as horrible. There were aspects of it that freaked me out, but they were heavily competed in against by the challenge, by the interesting aspects of it. And of course, all of us, everyone here in this room, if you're lucky, will live long enough to have a significant disability. I don't know anybody over 100 who doesn't use a wheelchair, for example. I don't know a one who doesn't at least have one as a backup. My folks are 89, and my dad is twisting my arm hard to design him something faster than a walker and less cumbersome than a wheelchair. Something to fill in that gap in the technology. My mom is really frustrated because she has to let him sit down and rest a little while every block. That's his limit. That's his range of walking these days with a couple of canes. So there are at least two sides to every argument. If I hadn't known these people, if I hadn't had the good luck to meet them before my own disability, who knows what my reaction would have been. If anybody has questions, comments, by the way, shoot right in. I'd rather be guided by you. Yes. Well, you know, it's a mixed blessing. I didn't have to rationalize the positive aspects. They were there, and I liked them. It's how I rationalized the negative aspects that was the hard part. And I spent a few weekends very early on cursing and making a racket and kind of got them out of my system to some extent. But about the same time, I was meeting a number of other people with much more significant disabilities than mine who were teaching me their tricks. And who could let me see easily beyond, and who also taught me the how to work with some of the challenges of, for example, their bowel, bladder sensation issues that are inconvenient, to say the very least. But there are ways to work with them, and the people were trying to develop ways to work with them better. Around the world, different groups were working in different ways. There was lots to learn that the medical profession in the U.S. did not yet know. This is in the 60s. And so that, by looking at the challenging aspect of it and realizing that I had the opportunity to perhaps make more difference than the average researcher because I had 24 hours a day to think about these issues. I had no choice but to think about these issues a lot. And so that gives kind of an automatic advantage. And with regard to wheelchair design, for example, I mean, here I am writing the stuff that we design. And I've done so now for, 45 years. And every day I run into something, I learn a little bit, either from others or from running into obstacles myself, situations that are a little bit different. So, whirlwind wheelchair, after I had ridden, well, my very first wheelchair was a standard chrome-plated. There was a monopoly in the wheelchair industry for 30 years, from 1950 to about 1980. And during that period, the prices went up and the quality went down. It was a near worldwide monopoly. They dumped chairs in the European countries in order to keep European competition out of the U.S. to maintain an over 95% virtual monopoly for over 30 years. Every single year, they had over 95% of the prescription. The full-time use wheelchair market is distinguished from the airport and nursing home models, the kind of box chairs. So I got one of these. Roger, yes? Oh, I tried. So they gave me one of these $2,000 in today's money, chrome-plated 50-pound monsters. And I headed out on the streets of Chicago, excited to be free from the hospital for the first time. Got it going with quite some difficulty because it was turning downhill so strongly. The weight on the front wheels was pulling them way downhill. A full third of the weight was on my front wheels, which turns out to be kind of crazy. And that was just how all chairs were at that time. So I would drag one hand, push with the other. Finally, I came to a flat spot in the sidewalk. It wasn't quite so inclined for drainage. Got it up to speed and bang, hit a big crack in the sidewalk. Stopped it cold, and then I tried to move forward and the chair wouldn't move. Tried to turn, I couldn't get it to turn. Looked down, my front wheel had been bent back, was rubbing on the frame. The front fork had been broken. When we dissected it later, we found the bearings had failed as well as the front fork. Turns out that whole assembly was designed for about a 200-pound force. Later on, I measured a typical low-speed impact force at 330 pounds. So, of course, it failed. And I had been a bicycle rider, racer, builder before that. Bicycles are wonderful. Good design from the 1890s has survived until today. Today's leading bicycle has 28-inch wheels. Almost all the world uses that except us. Bigger wheels. For $50, you can buy a bicycle that you can maintain for a lifetime. And I was riding one of these racers and having a lot of fun. Before my disability, and I could ride it all day over railroad tracks, no problem. Once over railroad tracks, these chairs would just fail. So I went looking for others working on the problem. I discovered this monopoly situation. I met with several small manufacturers, one in Ohio that was restricted pretty much to selling within Ohio. By illegal anti-competitive activities of the monopolist. In order to maintain a full monopoly, unless you have something that's so much better, it's hard to do it. Or unless you have very, very good patent protection, and the patents for this particular company expired, and the most important one expired in 1953. You have to play some tricks, and this company was playing tricks all over the country, all over the world, in fact. And so these little manufacturers, the ones that were hanging on by a shoestring, had a lot to tell me, and they had a good number of ideas in their back rooms that they had tried to introduce to the marketplace, but they didn't have the competitive power to get their chairs out beyond their local areas, like, for example, Ohio only, or another one was in Minnesota only. But Silly had a lot to teach me. I went and visited builders in Europe in the early 70s, in the Near East, found people experimenting a lot with chairs and making some progress. But because they couldn't really make a living at it, couldn't make a good living at it, they couldn't expand, and a good number of ideas were being lost along the way. In 1979, I visited Nicaragua, and there I saw something entirely different. People were pretty much living on these old box chairs thrown away in the north. Turns out in this country, if you have a wheelchair that's busted, it's beyond repair. Say you took it out and rode a half a block and hit a crack in the sidewalk. It's beyond repair. You can either give the garbage man an extra $10 to haul the thing away, because it's not normal garbage, or you can donate it to any one of a good number of charities and take a $300, $400 tax deduction, and the chair is then dumped in the southern half of the world. In Nicaragua, I met many people with chairs like that, and the most striking group I met were four teenage boys sharing one wheelchair. It had 20 fractures in the frame that had repaired all 20. Turned out that they would take turns with the chair, and whoever got the chair that day would ride it clear across Managua, usually to visit some girlfriend. And the chair would break along the way, and thus they had an excuse not to make it back until the next morning. When they got dragged back to the rehabilitation center, where they were, as newly disabled kids, getting trained in survival, they would take the chair down to a neighborhood blacksmith. That blacksmith and they would then figure out why the chair had broken, what the forces were, why something as fancy as a wheelchair and seemingly as well established, coming from a well-established industry, would break so easily. They would reinforce the chair, then they would reinforce the other side of the chair so that the other side wouldn't break either. When I looked over their chair, it was clear that they knew more than the U.S. industry put together, or at least they were able to act on what they knew better than the U.S. industry had been able to do. There were strong chairs available in the U.S. from these little manufacturers, but really the differences between poorly engineered, not engineered, Rube Goldberg sort of construction in most chairs, and the very good chairs from a few of these smaller manufacturers were being stopped cold. In the 1970s, we had a president who believed in free enterprise, Jimmy Carter. Didn't believe in monopoly, believed in competition. And when his Justice Department heard about the fact that the American monopolist was selling chairs in England for $135 for their so-called sports model, pretty good price in 1973 dollars, and was selling the exact same model number of chair in the U.S. for $500, they launched an investigation. It looked like there was dumping going on to keep out English manufacturing, English competition. And a few of us ran a little sting where we bought 10 chairs in London from that company, went right to their distributor and ordered 10 chairs for a basketball team in Washington, D.C. And they were very happy to get the order. A check for $1,350 was written for 10 chairs. And then they asked us, okay, when are you going to pick them up? And I said, well, can you just ship them to us in Washington, D.C.? And the guy's face went a little pale, and he went in the back room, came back a little later and said, well, we have communicated with our parent company in Los Angeles. We are informed that we are not allowed to ship to the Western Hemisphere. Bingo. That's illegal restriction of international trade. And one of my Republican friends, who also believed in free enterprise, amazing, some do, he was a Security Exchange Commission lawyer, also a wheelchair rider whose Monopoly-built chair broke down very regularly. He had taught us what the law was, and so when I came back, there were news reporters waiting for the information. When that news appeared in 300-some newspapers the next day, there was a lot of interest in what was going on in this fairly small industry. And in 1979, the antitrust suit that the Carter administration filed was settled. It was a classic consent decree in which the monopolies swear they had never done anything illegal and promised never to do it again. Within a couple of years, we had 24 new wheelchair manufacturers in the U.S. Prices had fallen to half what they were. Quality was way up. Bearing strength, other issues were much, much better. And we had progress, but at the same time, I was beginning to work in Nicaragua with these kids who wanted to set up a little factory and build their own. USAID provided us funding for the Center for Independent Living in Managua, Nicaragua. At least that's what the proposals all said. It had been their proposals had been translated by a woman working in the U.S. Embassy in Managua. And the Nicaraguan name for that organization was the Organización de Revolucionarios Deshabilitados Che Guevara. Very nice translation. It served the purpose very well and got U.S. funding for 4 years straight. And they were a very progressive group. They were a mix of people of various races and economic levels from very high to very low in Nicaragua. And they went to work trying to design their own chairs, did very well, and training people from other countries. I happily rode on their wave, learned what they had to teach. I helped them transfer their technology as best they could, and in the process start other groups up working or work with other groups like themselves who had started on their own, and steal all the good ideas, mix them all together as best we could, do lab testing in the U.S., and get things going. Eventually, we had manufacture going in over 40 countries, and San Francisco State University has started a center, Whirlwind Wheelchair International, as a kind of a home base, providing us lab equipment and a registered course in wheelchair design and construction. That enabled us, in particular, to snatch a handful of amazing Stanford students who came, took our class while they were students here, ended up coming back after school, and now are working with us in just as strong a way as you might ever imagine. They are right on the leading edge of wheelchair design in the world, and using all kinds of technological tools that I cannot, like very leading edge SolidWorks, not just simple diagrams, but stress analysis within SolidWorks and much more, and arranging for things like, well, we're working with manufacturers in various countries that are now getting bigger and becoming more automated. In the last few weeks, they've gone through several prototypes with a wheelchair builder in Indonesia. The Indonesians will send us diagrams by internet, SolidWorks. We'll plug them into a modeling machine, a 3D printer, And before long, we'll have a workable part to put right on the chair. We went through several generations of fender guards recently, and it would have taken us months 2 years ago to go through these iterations, but we did it in a matter of weeks. The chair I'm riding is one of our rough prototypes. The left side and the right side are quite different from each other in various ways because we're trying different things all the time. And I'm unfortunately the most convenient guinea pig. I have to ride the best and the worst of what our network comes up with. Let me do a quick demo of the basic difference between our current chair. A typical chair has a wheelbase 16 inch long, a manually pushed chair, a center of gravity 26 inches high. If you apply that ratio to a Toyota or a Chevrolet, how tall is the car? If the center of gravity is 1.5 times or more higher than the track length, it's about 3 stories tall. Drive that down the street, touch the brakes, and it falls on its face, of course. Well, that's what happens to many, many Americans every year who are wheelchair riders. The biggest source of injury to wheelchair riders in the U.S. is falling out forward, and that's measured by counting the number of wheelchair riders who land in emergency rooms. It's a count that goes back now 20 years, it's now thousands and thousands of people. Been in an emergency room for that, what I would call engineering defect. We need a longer wheelbase. Now here I see a couple of power chairs that are in the new generation, longer wheelbase, much stabler, lower center of gravity with the help, of course, of 100 pounds of batteries. Yours too, all state of the art. Manual chairs have not changed much. They've gotten lighter, faster, sleeker, and lots more expensive as they've gone to titanium and high tensile aluminum and other materials. None of that affects the 80% of the people in the world who live in the poorer countries, unfortunately. But at the same time, people in our 40 countries and more have put together their ideas and come up with chairs, a family of chairs like the one I'm riding. Let's see, how do I better unclip this microphone, or I'm going to bust a wire. Thanks. Temporarily. Can you push me up to the third step? So, now this chair, we're trying to set up training wheels so people don't tip over backwards while they're learning how to ride the chair. Training wheels in this country don't allow much backward tip. This one allows just enough tip so you can learn to climb curbs with it. A very, very important thing to do, especially if you live in a country that doesn't have curb ramps, or in Palo Alto, for example, which doesn't have curb ramps in most of the city. Most of the residential areas don't have them yet. It's moving ahead though. Palo Alto is ahead of most of the country. So, unfortunately, my wheelie bars prevent me from even setting my... Wait a minute. I'll set them up. So I have to hit it hard to get them on the top. Okay, can you give me a push up to the third step? Another push. And one more. Okay, now, my chair is shorter than standard chairs, because with a long wheelbase and a special wheel that we found in Zimbabwe on push carts, an ingenious design of front wheel, I think, my front wheels can be under my toes without raising my knees, above the kind of the minimum height that's needed to give footrest clearance on a standard wheelchair. And so I can turn around on this little space. My wheelie bars don't help, but they're temporary, I hope. With this longer wheelbase, 40% longer than the standard 16-inch. That's just enough that there's not enough energy that when my front wheels ram into a chuck hole and just get stopped cold, or into a, whatever, a curb that I'm trying to climb, but I miss that curb, there's not enough energy to lift me up and over the front wheels. And there's a 12-degree recline in the whole seating system, which is just enough so that I don't slide out. I'm a high-level pair. I don't have torso stability. So I need to design the chair so that it keeps me in. And ideally, well, I took about the angle of the seats you're all sitting in, a 12-degree recline. Maybe you're a 15 or a 16-degree recline. And that's a comfortable angle at which to sit. That's one in which I can work with my arms out, hit, whoop, there's my balance point. If I was sitting upright, like most, well, 4 degrees, 8 degrees at the top of the back of standard wheelchairs in the U.S. today, that's way too erect for me as a person with a disability, because I don't have the stomach muscles to push in, lift, thus inflating my rib cage upward and keeping me from falling forward. I wear a belt that does some of the job of stomach muscles that aren't working. Just an old motorcycle belt. Have I lost this? This wire is still... Yeah, I have lost this thing. Just a second here. Okay, now maybe the recording will work again. So, with a longer wheelbase, this is just enough to lose my balance as I'm going down. And my seat angle is just enough so I don't slide out.
And those things won't snag on
there. They will snag on there. That's a disadvantage. I would like, well, too bad this is not a longer class we could talk all night about the wide variety of improvements that
like
could be made.
Ones.
A retractable. Well,
or
trouble
adjustable.
With retractable is that you might forget to put it back out. But it could be spring-loaded.
Mm-hmm.
It could go all the way down to the ground, but retract itself and then spring back where it needed to be. So here I go down, and my rear wheels definitely will catch on that. There I am, spinning in thin air. Move forward a little bit, perhaps. Well, there's no tracks, and my wheels are in the air. There we go. There's something like that. Handy. Up. I'll show you this pump in a minute. It's another technological breakthrough that I'm quite happy with. There I am again, hung up. Have a pump. There we go. Oh, those were 6-inch steps. Here's a 7-inch step, a little bigger. But that sort of maneuver is the kind of stuff you run into every day. And if I didn't have these wheelie bars on, it would have been much, much easier. I could have just click, 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 turned around, spun around easily, click, click, down. And getting to school. I mean, if you're a person with a disability in a developing country, say you're living on $1,000 a year, you're well employed, but that's all the world system allows is about $1,000 a year for a skilled worker in many countries. And say you have a few kids to feed, a couple of kids. Say your significant other is staying home with you. 5 kilometers to get to school, then eventually to work, and there's no pavement. You better have a good chair. And this is the kind of obstacles that you're running into every single day. Here's a U.S. breakthrough that I like a lot. Just little details. A lot of our independence is in the details. We, of course, need to have pneumatic tires. They roll much, much more efficiently than any flat-free tire that's been there so far. That mic again, I will. The French pumps.
What's a French pump?
Leading French bicycle pump. Those you usually stick on the tire and you have to lean way over and pump like this. Not efficient. Not good leverage. Here's an old-fashioned hose pump that's been redesigned to the point where I have a feeling it's going to last at least 10 years. Very well designed. You can hook it on, you pump away. Fixing your own flats takes me about 10, 15 minutes. In fact, you'll see in our short slides that are coming up that I needed to demonstrate in Haiti to some new riders how to fix their own flats. It's not hard. You don't even have to get out of the wheelchair. 10 or 15 minutes. Can we run that 2 minutes of slides? Just came back from Haiti a few months ago. Worked in 3 different rehabilitation centers, brand new ones. Haiti has not had active rehabilitation, organized rehabilitation of people with spinal cord injuries previously, but now they're going great guns with the input of a good number of people from U.S. and especially Canada and Europe. Okay. I'll shut that off.
That, here?
Yeah. Okay. That's just an interruption. Okay, let me try. Yes. Oh yeah. There were probably thousands of spinal cord injuries in the earthquake, and there are only up to about a couple hundred known who survived. Most people didn't make it through. But of those who made it through and got to one of these rehabilitation centers, not a single one has passed away yet. They're handling their pressure sores, their other complications very, very well. When they get back home, some of them to very rural areas with no high-tech medical care, it will be more difficult, as it is in much of the world today, for them to keep going. Yep, go ahead. But they're sure going to try. Here are the people I met. Let me use your pointer.
You got bread in me.
Okay.
You got bread in me.
All right. Where is... Come on, computer. I don't know how that got there. I love computers. Oh. There we are. This is the American who funded the purchase of some now 500 wheelchairs. Made in Mexico, a few other places. This is a second rehab center way up in the north, Cape Haitian. Here I had to puncture my own tire to teach them how to patch a flat because nobody wanted to sacrifice their inner tube. I don't blame them. Took out the inner tube, got it back together.
You got a friend in me.
this girl had cerebral palsy, and she's going to do just fine. She had, of course, had been disabled well before the earthquake. Thanks to the earthquake, she's getting the supportive services and getting into regular public school, all the things she needed. So, other things that chairs need. Chairs could be so much better, should be. If you look at all three of these power chairs, they're all center of gravity drive. The drive wheels are at the middle. And the front ends and the rear ends are flexible. They move up and down. The thoughts for that technology have been around for about 20 years, but nobody has succeeded in applying them to manually propelled, lightweight, especially folding chairs. We have tried some going back 15 years within our project, and they worked great. But they were never quite cheap enough, simple enough to compete with the basic four-wheeled simple chair. Now that we have wheelie bars, though, that changes the equation a little bit. Now that it's recognized in many parts of developing countries that new riders need wheelie bars in order to be able to safely learn the tricks of the trade, get to the point where they can balance with no problem, with no fear of falling, and do so with the help of a very strong wheelie bar, one that they cannot break. That enables us now to add two more wheels, spend the money for two more strong wheels, and if we can then just go a little step further and have a very cheap way of making that wheelie bar really flexible so that you can lean way back, climb a bigger curb, go over a culvert without getting hung up in the middle with your drive wheels spinning in air, then we can move these drive wheels way forward, almost to the center of gravity. And now all of a sudden, there will be no weight on the front wheels pulling them downhill on a side slope. That will, on a typical outdoor run, again, we're on the edge of the road or on the sidewalk, if there are sidewalks, and that part of the edge of the road is always tilted for drainage. When we reach the point where we don't have to drag one hand and push the other, all of a sudden we've saved 50% of our propulsion energy. We can go twice as fast, twice as far, and have twice as much fun riding. And I've spent years in chairs like that. Again, they were a little too fancy or they had unsolved problems. One of the unsolved problems is we get pulled up and down stairs a lot in inaccessible environments. If you have wheelie bars in the way, it's much harder to pull a wheelchair up a stair. You can't lean the wheelchair way back and get help from the rider. So it takes, say, three people instead of just one to get you up and down stairs. We need to have ways of retracting the spring-loaded wheelie bar to get it totally out of the way for stairs, to have the chair not be unstable in that position, because what if you forget to redeploy the wheelie bar and then you push? I did that once in the New York City subway. Thanked the guy who had bounced me down a full flight of stairs. And we had tucked away my wheelie bar, spring-loaded wheelie bar, in order for him to be able to do that. I thanked him, gave one quick push because it was almost late for the subway, and bang! The back of my head hit the pavement. Well, that's got to be impossible to happen. It's going to take some hard thinking to put all of this together, to make a system that has all the advantages of the plain old-fashioned wheelchair. It's a hard act to follow because it does what it does so well. And to get the advantage of these hot new center of gravity balanced on the drive wheel chairs. And there's so many other things that need to be tried. So many details. Cushion design, cheap and simple for the rest of the world. We have good cushions in this country, but they cost $500 and they're not dependable. They can pop a leak and be unrepairable. When I've tried them, I've done it in just a few months. They've been beyond repair. Time to buy a new one. Well, that's not going to happen in most of the world. We're trying out a new one made out of a 16-inch Toyota tire, inner tube rather, that does more or less the same as the $500 model in a more dependable way, and in a way that you can put in a $5 inner tube for a complete rebuild if you need it. But there are still issues with that. Those cushions are waterproof, or if you're in a tropical environment and you sweat too much, you can get a pressure sore from the maceration of too much moisture on your skin by the end of a long day of living at 100 Fahrenheit. All of those things need to be solved in there, and there are scores of other basic problems that could be improved on, not just for developing countries, but for all of the world. And so if anybody's interested, we have a course, class in wheelchair design and construction. It meets every Tuesday evening. Each group of students builds a complete chair from scratch. You'll be taught by some of Stanford's best and brightest. And you're more than welcome to visit any Tuesday evening. Sign up for the class. It's the old-fashioned semester system up there. Between end of August and middle December, end of January and middle May. Thank you.
Thanks, Ralph. Anybody have any questions for Ralph?
Yes.
The cushion that you mentioned.
Yes. No, it's air filled. But any fluid is more or less the same, except that liquids can conduct heat a little better.
And suppose you use higher density liquids, so higher density more, better.
I'm not convinced that they necessarily do. Yes, the second leading wheelchair or cushion design in the US, the J cushion, does that. That means you can sit on a poorly designed cushion for an hour or two until you bottom out. And then you can lift up, resort it, and reposition yourself. I'm now healing a pressure sore from having tested one of those for a few months. The pressure sore came from maceration, though, not from poor pressure distribution. So an absorbent cover that would handle a day's tropical country sweat, maybe that's what it needs, or some... That wicks away.
Right.
Yeah, wicks it out to the edges and evaporates it from there. Wicking straight through, there's nowhere to go. It's got to wick horizontally 6 inches and do it really efficiently. Yeah, but that may exist by now, yes.
What was the basis of your MacArthur Award and what came of that?
I spent it all. And that was easy to do. I had a choice of paying 50% income tax on it or spending it all on the project right away. So I spent it all. It was for what I do. It was for working with organizations of disabled people in developing countries who build their own wheelchairs, and establishing this network of idea generators and traders that had been by that point in 1989 fairly successful. We were only 10 years old at that time, and. The growth rate, we've now made about 50,000 wheelchairs among us, which is not much considering there have been a good number of shops involved. But now the rate of production is well over 10,000 a year, and still every year it's gone up kind of exponentially. Now it's really taking off.
Are you familiar with Kenneth Barron?
Oh, absolutely, yes. Yes, and I work with them, have since their very beginning. That's in Danville. It's an organization that's given away hundreds of thousands of wheelchairs. I'm sorry? Over a million. Now, that could very well be. And they have good tires on their wheelchairs. They have pneumatics on the rear and a fat 8-inch wheel on the front, which are both, I think, very, very good choices of wheel type. Other aspects of their chairs, their quality control is very good. They're working with manufacturers in China to make chairs that do not break down unnecessarily. The design of the chair itself, unfortunately, is the same one that I had trouble with in 1966. And I'm hoping that as we get bigger and our chairs get cheaper because of larger scale manufacture, that they will enter their mix. Use their current chairs for people who are more working indoors or in institutions or
with limited range, and people who have gotten out and about and need to hit the road will have a better choice. But that's just great that they've done what they've done. They changed the whole mind of the world. Before 2000, when Ken Behring started, people did not believe that there was any point in working with wheelchairs for the 25 or more million people in developing world who need wheelchairs today and don't have them. That's a very conservative estimate. Maybe it's even four times that. But Ken Behring, working with Rotarians and others, changed the whole image of this issue so that people believe that it can and should be solved. And so I have a whole lot more to do as a result of his work. Yes. Very few. There have been about a million that have gone up from that group, and maybe another 300,000 from other groups. But those chairs have an average life of under 5 years. Under 2 years if they're used really actively, and they need major maintenance, at least preventive maintenance.
Do these people just get hauled around,
or they just stay? I mean, well, yeah, it depends on the culture and depends on the family how they get hauled around. But I lived with many people who had, a 50-foot radius from their house, yet they were fully employed, thanks to a family industry, TV repair, radio repair, sewing, other kind of high-tech professions.
And of the 25 million, if you put a wheelchair in a room, there would be basically left a wheelchair near them. How many of them would be able to figure out what to do with it? Or are they all
Well, most of the groups distributing wheelchairs now provide training, and that helps a lot. Most of the wheelchairs use bicycle technology or bicycle-related technology, and in most countries that bicycle repair is widely available, and thus it can be used. There are some issues with the types of bearings that are chosen, some of which are not available at all in country. For example, if you use English bearings and ship it to the real world, English inch-size bearings, you can't buy them anywhere in Africa. So that's a bit of a problem.
So
but
basically,
yeah. It's a little tricky, and we and others are working on those problems all the time. Yep. Often you need to go bigger rather than smaller, and so it's tricky. You need a long axle then and a long caster stem.
Okay, thanks again, Ralph, and I think we'll adjourn the class, and Ralph, stick around for a while in case you have any last minute questions. Thanks again, Ralph.